Okay, hello all. Thank you very much for coming. How's Dragon Con going for you so far? Great. Dragon Con makes me happy. I come here and you just walk down the hall and I just smile. I see costumes. I see, you know, people coming in and sitting in my talks, and I just love Dragon Con. It's like my home convention. So, hi, my name's Ilanka Dunin, and my day job is that I make computer games, and I also have an interest in cryptography and unsolved codes. How many people here have been to one of my talks before about codes? Okay, all right, good. I like to know, because, you know, sometimes I reuse the same jokes, you know, and if everybody had been, I'd come up, you know, maybe different jokes, but you'll be hearing some of the same ones. So how many people have been to my unsolved codes talk before? Okay, a couple. This is, it's going to be maybe about half the same as it was last time, but I have added in a bunch of new information. So this is a list. I have a web page with a list of famous unsolved codes, and it gets a lot of attention. It's gotten millions of hits. I should speak very briefly about how I got into codes. It was through Dragon Con. I was here in 2000, actually 1998, and then 99 and 2000, and I was here and I was speaking here in the EFF track, speaking about computer games. And while here, I got to meet other speakers, some of them hiding in the back there, hackers, who were coming in and talking about computer security and how people should lock up their computers. And so, you know, speakers meet speakers, we get together at the end of the day, have a beer, and through these hackers, I had heard about a code that was released at a hacker convention in Nashville called Freaknik, P-H-R-E-A-K-N-I-C. Still going. This year, what is it this year? Freaknik what?
Halloween weekend.
Halloween. Freaknik 18 is coming up, but Halloween. Definitely worth going. So I meet the hackers, and they say that at Freaknik 3, there had been a code released at the convention as a challenge for the folks at the conference, but no one had solved it. So the hackers are here, and they're giving out the flyer with the code saying, anybody who can solve it, you win a prize. You win a free trip to HackerCon. So I pick the flyer up along with all the other stuff you get at a convention. Take it home with me to St. Louis, where I'm from. And one day, I was homesick with the flu and just, what the hell, and I picked it up, and I started working on it, and I got obsessed with it. And that's what code breakers do, is they just get really antisocial and very, very, very focused. And I cracked it. It took 10 days, but I cracked it. I got to the center, and I won the prize, free trip to Freaknik 4, free hotel, free drinks, free t-shirts. And then I went around cracking a bunch of other codes in the hacker scene, so many that I've been banned from competition in the hacker scene. So at the AtlantaCon convention, when the code was released on a sheet of paper, the bottom of the page, it said, note, past puzzle crackers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving the AtlantaCon puzzle. Give someone else a chance, Ilanka. So I cracked that one too. and then September 11th, happened around then, and I was as enraged as everyone else by what had happened, and I was wondering if I could use my crypto experience to help out with the war on terrorism, sort of like in World War II, where the Bletchley Park effort that was in England, where they were working on the Enigma ciphers, the German Enigma, they needed folks in the public to help out. It was a very labor-intensive effort. So you know, in England, what they would do is they would put really hard puzzles in the newspapers and say, can you solve these? And if you could, they'd say, okay, you know, come on and help with the war effort. So so here we are after September 11th, and I call up my local FBI, and I said, hey, you know, can I help? And they said no. So then, but I kept calling back, and I kept calling back. And now we're gonna kind of do another parallel track in my life, which is that I was working on the Freaknik code around that time, or a little before that. And another track is that on September 11th, I actually have a cousin who works in Washington, D.C., and he had a very close call that morning. He was actually on his way to the Pentagon to give a briefing, but he was running late because he was having printer problems. And then he got those fixed, he got things printed out, he was on his way, he checked his cell phone for messages, his cell phone actually crashed from all the messages on it from people saying a plane just hit the Pentagon, don't go. And the plane hit right where he was supposed to be, so some of the people he was supposed to brief were killed. So after that, for Thanksgiving that year, I flew out to D.C. to hug my cousin, I'm glad he was okay, and we went to a memorial at the Pentagon, we put an American flag there. And then we were driving around, and he said, well, this is your first time in D.C. Is there anything else you'd like to see? And I said, no, just you. And he said, well, that's nice. I like seeing you, too. But really, Washington, D.C. kind of has a few tourist attractions. Is there anything else you'd like to see? And you know, I said, you know, when I was working on that Freaknik 3 code, there were some dead ends. There were some red herrings built in as part of the code. And one of the dead ends was a link to the CIA website saying, go solve this. And what it was is it was a link to a sculpture, a picture of a sculpture, and you can see at the top left here, called Kryptos. Kryptos is at in the courtyard between the original and new headquarters buildings, and I'll be giving you more information about it as part of this talk. And so the link was pointing to the website, and I was, what's Kryptos? Do I have to solve this to solve the Freaknik 3 code? And oh, ha ha ha, it's got four codes on it. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth hasn't been solved yet. It's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. Ha ha ha, thank you, Johnny X. And then I went back to solving the rest of the cipher, which I did. The actual answer to the Freaknik cipher was, once I'd gotten to the center, Johnny X had not assumed that the person to solve it might be a girl, so it was a little on the sexist side. To announce my win, I needed to post a haiku message, or a sonnet, I chose haiku, a haiku to one of the hacker mailing lists. And in the haiku, I needed to say why I like to go swimming with bow-legged women and swim between their legs. yeah. So the haiku that I came up with was, Johnny X and I will discuss things aquatic if he wears a suit. And that was my announcement that I'd cracked the Freaknik code. So anyway, that's how I'd heard about crypto. So now we bounce back over to my cousin and I driving around Washington, D.C. And I said, well, you know, yeah, there is something I'd like to see. I'd like to go see that sculpture, Kryptos. He said, where is it? I said, well, it's at the center of CIA headquarters. He said, okay, that's Langley, Virginia. And we had a little trouble because, you know, there's no street address for CIA. You can't just go and go. And there was no Google Earth at the time. But I kind of figured out, because I sort of knew what the building sort of looked like from above, from Tom Clancy movies, where they go like, CIA. And I got some satellite reconnaissance pictures of the Langley, Virginia area, sort of like Google Earth, and went looking around until I found the building, and then I knew where CIA was. So my cousin and I go driving over there, and we figure we're just going to drive along the service road and kind of peek over the wall and see if we can see Kryptos. But when we get there, there's no service road. There's just the exit, and then there's a big gate and barbed wire and a guard shack and big guys with guns coming pouring out of the guard shack asking very reasonable questions right after September 11th. Who are you and why are you here? So my cousin and I were like, oh, we're here to see Kryptos. And the guards kind of relaxed. Said, sorry, you can't get in. It's official business only. So my cousin and I are kind of, okay, can we talk our way into CIA? So we're thinking, okay, well, you know, is there a public tour day? And the guard said, no, sorry, official business only. We said, well, you know, could I get an invitation from my senator or my congressman? Sorry, official business only. And we're going through all these things, and we couldn't come up with anything. And like I said, these are big guys with guns. So finally, you know, we said, okay, you know, and we drove away. But I kept thinking, official business only, official business only. So now we come back to this other thing with the FBI, St. Louis FBI, where finally I kept calling back and said, can I help, can I help? And finally one of the agents said, what is it you know about? What kinds of codes? And I said, well, you know, the PGP and UU encoding, steganography and Route 13. And they go, wait, steganography. We've been hearing rumors that Al-Qaeda was using steganography as a way of planning the September 11th attacks. Now, steganography, for those who don't know, is a way of hiding messages inside of pictures. So you can see a picture, and behind the bits of the picture or hidden in many different ways, there might be a message. So the FBI agent said, okay, you know, there's probably big brains in Washington, D.C. that know about this stuff, but we're here in St. Louis. Cryptography is not really our mission. Maybe you could put together a talk about steganography and come in and give it one of our task force meetings. I said, sure. So I think they thought I was going to do a little 10-minute talk, but I put together a full 70-slide PowerPoint presentation about steganography and how I don't think that Al-Qaeda was using it, but then I researched what kind of codes they were using, and then I found out where the rumors about steganography came from. And I gave this talk, and as I was putting together the talk, I was thinking, official business, maybe I can use this talk as the official business that's going to get me into CIA. So you have to have a goal. And Will Wright, famous game designer, did The Sims, was once asked, what is the secret of success? And he said, pathological persistence. Okay, so here I am. I'm gonna get into CIA. So while I was putting together my slides, one of the slides in my talk needed to be a picture that had nothing hidden in it, and that same picture with something hidden in it. So you could see both of them and see that there was really no difference between the two images. And what picture? I could use a picture of a rose, of a building. I chose to use a picture of Kryptos. So I have this slide with a picture of Kryptos that I got from the CIA headquarters website, and I said, okay, here's this image of Kryptos that doesn't have anything hidden. Here's something that does have something hidden. By the way, that sculpture's at CIA. I'd love to give this talk at CIA someday. So I give the talk at St. Louis FBI, and there's other agents there. There's people from the FBI, from U.S. Attorney General, Secret Service, postal inspectors, local police. Talk is really well received, and then I started getting invited all over the place to give this talk again. Everyone's very interested, so I'm going to universities and different conventions, including HackerCons. So, and every time I give the talk, I show that slide, and I'd say, boy, I'd love to give this talk at CIA someday. So, I'm at DEF CON, Las Vegas, biggest hacker convention in the world, all right? I'm in the big roof tent, 1,000 people there. I'm giving my talk about steganography and Al-Qaeda codes and showing my slide. Oh, by the way, I'd love to give this talk at CIA someday. At the end of the talk, someone comes up. People come up, they give you business cards and things. And someone comes up, they lean across the podium and they look at me and they say, I work at Langley. I think I can get you in. Okay. So here's an undercover CIA, well, they were undercover CIA agent at DEF CON. So all I got was a first name and a phone number. And so then I was saying, okay, you know, is this really a CIA agent, or is this, you know, hackers pulling my chain and pretending to be a CIA agent? So a couple days later, I call the phone number after, and I say, okay, I'd love to give my talk at CIA. I really just want to see the crypto sculpture, so I don't want to be paid. Just, you know, give me. And they said, okay, we'll send us your slides. And I said, okay, wait, prove to me you work at CIA. And they said, well, how do we do that? And I said, well, send me an email from an official CIA address. And they said, I don't have an email from an official CIA address. I said, well, get an email from an official CIA address. About a week goes by, I get an email from at ucia.gov, unclassified CIA.gov. So now, also, I wrote back to that email to make sure I wasn't just getting a spoofed email address. So we had two-way communication. And so they'd affirm they were at CIA, and they wanted me to come speak. And I kept saying, don't pay me. I just want to be able to see Kryptos. And they kept insisting that they had to pay me. And I said, fine, you know, I didn't want to name a price that was too high, you know, because I really wanted to see Kryptos. And they said, how much do you want? I said, just name it, and I'll say yes. And they said, no, how much do you want? And I said, well, I'm staying with my cousin. I, you know, airfare, fine, $500. But if that's too much, it's okay. You know, I really just want to see Kryptos. And they come back a few days later, and they say, okay, we're going to bring you in. You get a chance to see Kryptos, and we're going to pay you $2,500. So this is me negotiating with the government for your tax money. Okay. So I did get a chance to get in, and I did get to see Kryptos. I'll show you some more slides of my visit to CIA, but that was kind of how I got involved with this whole thing, you know, through Dragon Con, then Freaknik, and then Kryptos. And I got some rubbings of the sculpture, and when I got back to St. Louis, I kind of put the rubbings online. Okay, now I'd achieved my goal. I had visited Kryptos, so I had a little Nilanka's visit to CIA, sort of an early blog, and I posted my rubbings. And that webpage changed my life, because all of a sudden I started getting letters from all over the world from people who were interested in Kryptos, saying, oh, you saw it, did you see this, did you see that, can you tell me, who made Kryptos? And they'd say, oh, I've solved part four. And I'd say, okay, great, can tell me what part four says, and I'll put it on my website. They said, well, if you take this letter and this letter and this letter, it's my home address, it's proof that the government is watching me. Thank you very much. Can you give me a repeatable method on this? They usually couldn't, but so I was getting a lot, and I still get these. I get a couple of these a week. There's just people that are just obsessed by these codes, and they pick out things that they want to see, and then they just kind of ignore the rest of it. Or they find something and they pick out a T and H and an E, and they think they have the word the, and then they call me at my answering machine at home and say, I've solved it, Ilanka. Here's the word the. You do the rest. And that's typically how it goes. And if you talk to other people that have dealt with cryptography, for many of these unsolved codes, it's what happened. People think they found some little piece, and then I'll let the big brain solve the rest of it. And it's really not a solution. So anyway, so I'm cryptos and people are writing to me and I'm making an FAQ on my website and things are growing and then people are asking me how famous is cryptos and I don't know. So I go and I make this list of unsolved codes and then start getting correspondence about some of those. And then some real cryptographers write to me and they say, I've done this research. Maybe we should start a discussion group. And we start a discussion group and thousands of people start joining these discussion groups. And around 2003, I get a call from an author who's written a book called The Da Vinci Code. And he says, cryptos is going to be a theme in his next novel. Will I give him some information about the sculpture? I say, sure. And so he calls me up periodically asking me questions about it. Also, any of you that have this edition of The Da Vinci Code, there are puzzles hidden in the artwork. Let me see if the light's right. There are puzzles hidden in the artwork of the book jacket. And these are something that he's done with other novels as well, where he's giving clues to the subject of his next novel. Two of the five puzzles here refer to cryptos, and I'll show you slides of those in a couple minutes. So the next novel, which was called The Lost Symbol, takes place in Washington, D.C., and cryptos is a theme throughout this book. And I was surprised when I read the book, about halfway through, there's a character that shows up named Nola Kay, which is an anagram version of Ilanka. It was what Dan Brown's way of thanking me for the research by naming one of the characters after me. So on my list of famous unsolved codes, I've gone over different ones of these at different times at DragonCon. For this particular talk, I'm going to focus on 1, 2, and 5, Beale ciphers, the Voynich manuscript, the crypto sculpture, and also talk very briefly about the Dorabello cipher. The Beale ciphers in particular, those of you that have been to my talks before, I've got a ton of new information about the Beale cipher, so we'll get to that. But let me talk about Voynich first, because this is probably the oldest one on the list. And I have, there's very few of these, a complete replica of the Voynich manuscript up here if anybody wants to take a look. This is a manuscript that's hundreds of years old, that has hundreds of pages and hundreds of pictures. And we can't read any of it. We don't know if it's a different language. We don't know if it's a cipher. We don't recognize any of the letters. The alphabet is completely unlike anything we've ever seen. And there's hundreds of pictures of plants, and we can't identify any of the plants. So it's sometimes referred to as the world's most mysterious manuscript. There has been some radiocarbon dating of the pages. And you can go online and you can see pictures of the different pages. There's only one copy in existence. It's currently at Yale University at the Beinecke Rare Book Library. And each this is pretty much actual size for the pages. And I went and I downloaded all the images of all the pages and figured what went on the reverse side of what. And there are some pages that kind of fold out. And anybody that's interested in seeing these in more detail, you can definitely come up and take a look at this later. Because it's just fascinating. Whoever did it, they obviously had access to some financial resource, because each one of these pages is made on parchment of a vellum. And vellum is sheepskin. So basically each one of these pages came from the belly of a sheep, the skin there. So we've radiocarbon dated radiocarbon dated it, and we know that the sheep from whom the vellum was made lived in the early 1400s. Which may mean that the manuscript was made in the early 1400s, or it may mean that it was a copy of something older, and that copy was made in the 1400s, or it might mean that much later someone obtained a blank book of 1400s parchment that had not yet been written on vellum, and then proceeded to create the document from there. But there's been chemical analysis done of the ink, iron gall ink, and of the paints, of the different plants there, and it's all comparable, consistent with the 1400s. But we cannot identify these plants. And then there's all these little pictures, these little naked women they're bathing in something, and these somethings always tend to have, my mouse is going, there's always an inflow, and then there's always an outflow. And it's done in a very kind of organic system. And then these plants, like some of you might look at that and go, oh, that's a passion flower. But no, passion flowers have 10 leaves. Anybody who studies plants knows passion flowers have 10 petals. This one says 5. Why? We don't know. if we were to transcribe it. And the Voynich manuscript came to public attention in 1912 when a Polish-American book dealer was buying some manuscripts. There was a monastery south of Rome called the Villa Mondragoni, and they were running a little low on funds, so they were very discreetly selling off some of their manuscripts. And Voynich, Polish-American book dealer, went in and bought several manuscripts, and he bought this one as well. And so that's why it's named after him, Voynich, even though he's just the one that brought it to modern attention. So, big mystery. Villa Mondragoni, some of you may have heard of, because it's where Pope Gregory would spend the summer, and it's where he signed the decree creating the Gregorian calendar. Right. So, it does seem to have reference to herbs. This is a separate document, the De Materia Medica from the 15th century, which looks similar. It's got text, it's got plants, but these plants we can identify and the text we can read. This is another one from the 6th century, Vienna Dioscuridis. My Latin is not good. If someone else wants to pronounce that better, feel free. And there's a close-up of an actual passion flower, and then what's in the Voynich manuscript. Other interesting diagrams in there, we have these long tubes. What are these tubes? Well, potentially they were microscopes, so someone was looking at plants. And there are interesting, the way they would do microscopes is they would often have them in these vertical cylinders. However, lenses and all that really didn't start coming into vogue until like around the 1600s, Galileo, and this is from the 1400s. So again, just a mystery of what exactly this means. Some of these fold-out things, this is probably the most famous page in the Voynich manuscript. It's called the Rosettes page. It looks sort of like a map or a star chart of some sort. Again, we just don't know. But whoever did it put a lot of work into it. There is one clue here as to where it may have come from, which is up in one of the rosettes, kind of in the circle, there's a little picture of a castle, and it has these battlements with this dip in it. It's called a swallowtail merlon. And today, you can find castles like the one at the bottom right there, and they're kind of all over the place. But at the time that the manuscript was created, they really only existed in one part of the world, which was in northern Italy, which may imply that the manuscript came from that area. We don't know. So, is it a code or is it a hoax? It was purchased by Emperor Rudolf in the 16th century for 600 gold ducats, that would be about $80,000. And he was known for collecting curiosities, so perhaps somebody created a curiosity for the emperor to separate him from hundreds of gold ducats. Don't know. So is it a hoax? If it's a hoax, it took a long time to make this hoax. Maybe it's an artificial language. There's been a lot of study from it. The code breakers from World War II that actually cracked, like the Japanese purple cipher, spent some time working on codes in their off time of some recreational codes. And they turned to the Voynich manuscript at one point, put quite a bit of research into it, couldn't crack it. Their guess was that it was an artificial language, but the patterns weren't quite right. Maybe the whole thing was created by someone who was mentally ill, schizophrenic. And they just liked to draw and would just sit and draw these plants. And maybe they came from a wealthy family and the family just kept giving them the inks and the vellum. It would not have been cheap to make a manuscript of this size. So again, it just questions. Is it encrypted? Maybe. Or maybe there was an actual language at the time. There's all these little micronations around Europe. Maybe there was a micronation, and this was their language. This was their alphabet, and all other examples of the language have just disappeared. We've never found any other document anywhere that uses that alphabet, that uses that language. So maybe it was a micronation. Maybe there was that, and they had several examples of this script, and everything else just got lost over the years, and the Voynich survived because it's pretty, because it has all these interesting images in it. Don't know. Alchemy was popular around the time. The Philosopher's Stone, maybe somebody was writing it in code so that they wouldn't get in trouble with the Inquisition. Maybe someone was hearing voices and was writing what they thought they were hearing. There's just all kinds of speculation about it, and anybody can speculate about anything. Oh, it's space aliens. But we have nothing. We have no proof. We just have this really mysterious manuscript. So just again, summary. It was created in the early 1400s. Style implies Northern Italy. We know the way it was written. We know it was left to right. But it's not something we can identify. Question. Wait, he needs the thing, the box. Yep, pass it to this young man kneeling on the floor.
The box.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to the box.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't there some parts of the Voynich manuscript that we did find out correlated to actually, you know, existing things in the botanical section, like flowers that we thought that we had no idea of but then found later on?
Yeah, and it's a good question because frequently the Voynich manuscript will show up in the news. Someone will say, aha, I have identified this plant, and it'll be picked up by the newspapers, but then other botanists will say, no, that the flowers are right for that plant, but those roots would never match that type of flower, or the leaves are right, but that flower would never be swimming with that leaves. It's almost like we have roots, leaves, and plants that have all kind of been spliced back and forth, which might tie into the alchemy theory. So. You are correct in that some people have said that they've identified the plant. Some people have said that they've identified a word. There was just a couple months ago, there was a university professor who said he had solved, air quotes, solved the Voynich manuscript because on one thing he'd seen a place where he thought he identified a word. And the newspaper, oh my God, professor from so-and-so has solved the Voynich manuscript. But those of us that are in the code scene go, okay, reported solution number 5 of 2014, because there's like hundreds of them. And until, even Scientific American did something where someone had said they'd solved the Voynich manuscript, and he had something called a Cardan grill. And he said, well, it was probably made like this, where you would hold a template over it, and then you would just copy different letters. And Scientific American covered it, wrote a wonderful article about this man's theory, and I wrote to him and I said, okay, interesting theory. Can you use your theory to replicate a single paragraph in the Voynich manuscript? And he said, well, no, not yet. Hadn't done that. So he just had a really interesting theory. Okay, good. Oh, we need the box over here.
Yep.
Catch.
Can you really throw this?
Yeah. I've never seen a microphone box before. I'm intrigued. My question is, has any work or what work has been done to identify wealthy houses from Northern Italy in the 1400s? Because I'm in my head, I'm thinking, okay, well, we can't figure out what, but is there been work to figure out who?
Mm-hmm. And that's a wonderful angle of attack. It's very possible that there might be some other documents that use this kind of language and it's just buried in a chest in somebody's basement in one of the castles in Northern Italy. Stuff like this is coming up all the time. There's a couple websites that you can go to that spend some time. I think this castle where someone was going through and looking at all the artwork around the castle and saying, oh, there's a picture of an eagle. It looks very much like the flower that's on this page of Voynich. Or here's a woman who's standing in this pose, which is very similar to one of the images in Voynich. So I think it's a wonderful avenue of research, and there's probably more that can be done. Speak into the box.
What do you think of the theory that John Dee was the author of the manuscript?
There are lots of theories about the Voynich manuscript, and some interesting theories that there were some famous hoaxers around the time who this is the kind of thing that they might have done. It's possible, very possible.
Yeah, but John Dee was the famous occultist that
Okay, he's saying John Dee, who is the famous occultist who worked for Mary Tudor. Again, it's possible, but people can say all kinds of things. I'd like to see what is the proof. Just because there was someone around that time, it's sort of like all these theories about did Shakespeare really write his sonnets? And people can say, it must have been Bacon, or it must have been De Vere, or it must have been this person. People can say anything. And they can, I mean, it's possible. I'm not saying it's not possible, but I would want to see more proof. And with Shakespeare, and that's probably something that would be worth a whole panel maybe next year about Shakespeare and the Baconian theories. Reputable historians have discredited all of these speculations many, many times, saying, no, Shakespeare wrote his stuff. And people say, oh, but, you know, Shakespeare couldn't write his name. Well, penmanship is not required to write a good play. And the plays were generally published in printed form. But anyway, I am digressing here. Say anybody can say anything, but where's the proof? Where's the proof? Okay. Going on? All right. Went through that. Yep. Yep. Did that. No, was there another question? Okay. All right. So, moving on to another cipher that's on the list, Dorabella cipher, very briefly. This was written by composer Edward Elgar. So if you go to a graduation ceremony, da-da-da-da-da-da, that was Elgar. And he was also interested in codes, and he actually hid some stuff in some of his music. For example, he did a series of music called the Enigma Variations, where each variation was identifying one of the friends in a circle of friends. And other composers have done this as well. But the big cipher here is that he had written a message. He had a younger woman friend, Miss Dora Penny, 22 years old, not a cryptographer. And he had sent a message, I think, to her aunt. And then on the back of it, there was a message to Dora, and this was the message. And we have no idea what it says. She later wrote in her memoirs, and she reproduced it and said, I would appreciate if someone could tell me what it says. It looks like a simple substitution cipher. It looks like something you just swap one thing for another letter. Many, many theories, many, many people have said, oh, well, it must be related to music, and you know, music going up and music going down. But no one has come up with an answer that satisfies the general community. There are several people who say, I have solved the cipher, but none of them have risen to the bar that I would accept yet. If Kryptos is solved, and I don't want to necessarily be the one to solve it, I just want to see it solved. I want it off my plate. The next one I'd probably work on would be Dorabella, because I've heard that Elgar had other examples of these cipher systems that were in his personal papers. So I'd want to go see these museums and see these other examples. And if we could maybe solve some of those, then that might give us more information about this particular one. So, Beale ciphers. This is the most new stuff is going to be here. So, Beale ciphers, this is a pamphlet. One pamphlet, several copies of which were published in Bedford County, Virginia in 1885. And in this pamphlet was a story and three encrypted messages. One of the messages has been solved, two of the others have not. The one that was solved was solved with the Declaration of Independence. So if you've seen the movie National Treasure, it's kind of loosely based on some of this stuff. And according to the pamphlet, in the mid 1880s, actually it was in the earlier than that, 1800s, I need to fix that slide, a man named Thomas Beale arrived in Bedford County, Virginia, and he had a story. And the story was that he was from Virginia, he was a Virginia gentleman, and he and about 30 of his friends had headed west to go adventuring, to go hunt buffalo and whatnot. And that while they were north of Santa Fe, which probably would have been the area today we'd call southern Colorado, they had stumbled across a mine of gold and silver, right there on the surface, gold and silver. And they then proceeded to mine it for the next 18 months, these 30 men, and got hundreds of pounds of gold and silver. And then they charged this man, Beale, to carry it by wagon back to Virginia and to hide it in a safe location so that they could all recover it later. Along the way, Beale said he stopped off in St. Louis and traded some of the gold and silver for gems to make it easier to carry everything. So by the time he gets back to Bedford, we now have iron pots with iron covers with gold and silver and gems, a fabulous treasure, which he reportedly buries within a few miles of Buford's Tavern in Bedford County. And then he gives an iron box, a locked box, to the innkeeper, Robert Morris, really existed, a trustworthy individual, and with instructions that if Beale never returned, to go ahead and open the box. A few months later, Beale did send a letter to Morris saying that he would also be sending a key for the ciphers that were in the box. Such key never arrived. Beale was never heard from again. So as the pamphlet goes on, it says that 22 years later, quite a while, Morris decides to open the box, and he finds some letters, and he finds these three ciphers. Can't do anything with them. Decades later, as he's an older man, he passes these messages off to an unnamed friend. That unnamed friend figures out how to decrypt paper number 2 using the Declaration of Independence. cannot solve the other two papers, and then decides to wash their hands of it, writes everything they know about it in this pamphlet, which they then have published by another friend, James B. Ward. This is in 1885. So this is a picture of paper number two. It's a long series of numbers. This is the one that according to the pamphlet, is solved, and it's been verified mostly that it's solvable. You take the Declaration of Independence, and I realize it's very fine print here, but when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and then you number each word. And then on the cipher, the numbers are like 115, 73, 24, and so forth. So 115, you go to the 115th word, you take the first letter of that word, I. Instituted was the word, you take the letter I. And then you go to the 73rd word, which is hold, and you take that first letter, which is H. And you keep going, I-H-A-V-E, I have. And you keep going through all those numbers, and you pull out the message. So the plain, what this is called, so this is the key here, and then the plain text for it is, I have deposited in the county of Bedford, about 4 miles from Beaufort's, in an excavation or vault, 6 feet below the surface of the ground, the following articles, belonging jointly to the parties whose names are given in number 3 herewith. The first deposit consisted of 1,014 pounds of gold and 3,812 pounds of silver, deposited November 1819. The second was made December 1821 and consisted of 1,907 pounds of gold and 1,288 pounds of silver, also jewels, obtained in St. Louis in exchange for silver to save transportation and valued at $13,000. The above is securely packed in iron pots with iron covers. The vault is roughly lined with stone, and the vessels rest on solid stone and are covered with others. Paper number one describes the exact locality of the vault so that no difficulty will be had in finding it. So this pamphlet sold briskly. There were many people who were very interested in it all over the area. And since the late 1880s, it's been over 100 years now, many people have gone to Bedford County with shovels and bulldozers and dynamite, and many, many holes have been dug around the landscape such that some farmers are said to just shoot first and ask questions later. But no treasure has been found. So was there a real treasure? Don't know. Paper number one, the locality of the vault, also a series of numbers. There's some pretty intense cryptanalysis that has been done on this that implies that there's no code here. Jim Gologli wrote a really interesting report a couple decades ago where when he put computers on it, he couldn't find any English text, but he did find the alphabet going through. A, B, it was like C, C, D, D, E, E, which... So it wasn't obviously not random numbers, but why would the alphabet be there? Others would argue that the fact that the alphabet was found means that there must be another layer to the cipher. Right. And then this is paper number three, which supposedly has the names and residences of these 30 individuals, along with their next of kin and the addresses of the next of kin. So, was it real? Was it a hoax? Well, the general consensus is that it was a hoax. There's inconsistencies in the language. For example, in the story, there's things about, well, we stumbled upon the mine because we were following this stampede of buffalo. Well, the word stampede really wasn't in the language at the time that they were saying it was. It didn't come into the language until much later, which implies that that's when the story was written, was much later. Also, let's just do the sniff test on the story here. 3 wagons full of gold and silver that they're transporting from New Mexico, Colorado, all the way to Virginia and buried in Virginia. Why? Why take it all the way back to Virginia? Also, I've got to say, 30 guys mining gold for a year and a half and word doesn't get out? Think about the gold rush. Think about 1849 when that rumors got out and it spread like wildfire. The idea that dozens of people were mining that much gold in that area and no word got out is highly unlikely. So, also, paper number three. In one of the letters, suppose again, all of this is just from the one pamphlet, in one of the letters it said, you will find in one of the papers written in cipher the names of all my associates who are each entitled to an equal part of our treasure, and opposite to the names of each one will be found the names and residences of the relatives and others to whom they devise their respective portions. From this you will be enabled to carry out the wishes of all by distributing the portion of each to the parties designated. This will not be difficult, as their residences are given and they can easily be found. Well, first of all, why encrypt the names of the people who own the treasure? Why would it be necessary to keep that secret? Also, 30 people, their relatives, and their residences, it's only got 618 characters. I do some division here. So it just doesn't feel right. It feels like this was just a made-up story, an urban legend of the late 1800s. Again, this is paper number 3 that supposedly has all that information. It's possible someone could come up with a really interesting algorithm to compress that much of information into a very small packet, but again, unlikely. So, to get more information on this, I would say tune in a few months. There's a UK TV television show called Myth Hunters, and it has been announced that in their third series there will be an episode on the Beale Ciphers. And the talking head on this series will be me. So I'm looking forward to seeing the show as well. So now let's go on to cryptos, one of my favorite topics. How are we doing on time? Okay. So about 12 feet tall, 20 feet long, these large copper plates. The letters are carved through it, so you're seeing through it, you're seeing the plants on the other side. It was commissioned in the late 1980s when the CIA they'd outgrown the original headquarters building, and they were creating a new headquarters building, and they were also commissioning art to go around the new building. And they put together a committee, which put together a committee, which put together a committee to choose who would be the artists that would create this art. So the Art and Architecture Program, they reached out to a Washington, D.C. artist named Jim Sanborn, who had never done anything with codes on them, but he had done several other large art pieces around the Washington, D.C. area. And he had a theme in his art of trying to make invisible forces visible. That was something he liked to do as an artist. For example, magnetism. If you could walk into a gallery and there might be hundreds of needles all suspended by strings from the ceiling, nothing touching the needles, but they're all pointing in the same direction at a lodestone, which is at the far end of the room. So it was his way of trying to show through art the lines of magnetic force. And he would do this with the Coriolis effect and the forces that would bring lightning in. And the committee liked the idea of this making the invisible visible, because they felt that tied with the theme of the CIA, the intelligence gathering. So they offered the bid to Sanborn, who said yes. And then after he got it, he started doing some research and decided he wanted to do a sculpture with a theme of cryptography. He didn't know cryptography, but the director of the CIA at the time, William Webster, teamed Sanborn with Ed Scheidt, who was the chairman of a CIA cryptographic center. Ed taught Jim about codes, Jim chose messages, and then encrypted, carved these messages into the copper. When I got into CCIA, as I mentioned, I did some rubbings. And these are two of the rubbings. Each one of these is done on an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper. So you can kind of get an idea of the size of the letters that are on the sculpture. As I researched it, I learned that CIA was big in the news in 1999, which is when the first three parts were publicly solved. A man named Jim Galogli, who was the head of the American Cryptogram Association, had announced his solution of the first three parts. It made an international news. But then after he made his announcement, well, the CIA came forward and said, well, we have somebody that actually solved it last year, David Stein. Internally, we just announced it internally. We didn't think it was that big of a deal. Again, he had only solved the first three parts. Then the NSA comes forward and says, well, we have people that have solved it too, but we're not going to tell you who, and we're not going to tell you when. Very NSA, very no such agency. And you know, I found out some parts of it. So this was in 1992. It's true, the NSA did work on it. And what I've discovered is that the CIA's deputy director in 92, so the sculpture was installed in 1990. And in 92, the new deputy director at the CIA, this was Admiral William Studeman, who'd worked at the NSA before, went and said, okay, you guys are so hot, let's see how hot you are, go solve this sculpture crypto. So the NSA's director, Vice Admiral John Mike McConnell, he took up the challenge and they formed a team to use the NSA computers and try and crack the ciphers on cryptos. They did solve the first three parts by December 1992, couldn't solve part four, sent a memo to CIA, and basically they would have needed more information. If this would have happened in the field, they probably would have stamped this as needs more collection, because it's very difficult to crack a cipher when you've only got a very small piece of it. They would have wanted to get more examples. When the Allies cracked the Enigma ciphers, they had large quantities of ciphertext to work with, and that's what helped to identify the mathematical patterns. So I wanted, as I'm doing my website and I'm creating my FAQ, and I've got the information, I've got the report that David Stein wrote, and I've talked to Jim Galogli, and I go to the NSA, and I say, can I have your notes about cryptos? And they said, well, no, that's classified. And I say, hang on, this is a recreational cipher. This is not a matter of national security. Why does it have to be classified? Oh, well, you know, we've used, you know, classified methods in computers. And I was like, no. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request on the NSA. It took quite a while. I filed this in March 2010, and they wrote back, and they're very polite, you know, there's going to be search fees and copying fees, are you willing to pay? And I said yes, and go back, and then a couple more months go by, and then they said, our search is completed, and you have been placed in the first in, first out processing queue for non-personal easy cases. However, since there were several cases ahead of mine, they were unable to respond within 20 days. And I said, this was in June 2010. So I'm like, okay, all right, fine, I can wait 20 days. 6 months go by. Okay, I write to them and I say, how's it going? And I get this nice message. The referenced case is actively being worked and, in fact, has already made it through the first level of review. There are additional review and approval stages, and there are other cases ahead of yours, so it may be some time before you receive the response. Okay. 6 months, right back. How's it going? FOIA case is in the final approval stages. Another few months go by. How's it going? Oh, it's in the final approval stages, but there's still a number of cases ahead of you. So this goes on. I keep pinging them. 3 years later, I get a manila envelope, and there's the documents. So it was finally approved, heavily redacted. I published this on my website. Again, it made international news. And they've also published it on the NSA website now. They have a transparency section where they listed all the crypto stuff. But I wanted to point out that there at the bottom where it says approved for release by NSA on May 21st, 2013, FOIA case 61191, that's me. And I want to say it is possible to get information out of the NSA legally and then not have to go hide in Moscow. Okay? So it does affirm that, and everything in the document said the same thing. It solved the first three parts, but hadn't solved the fourth part yet. So going back to my own research about cryptos, as I'm writing to art galleries all over, tell me everything you know about Sanborn, because I wrote to his agent, and I said, hey, can you send me a list of everything Sanborn's ever done? They said, there's no such list. It would be impossible to make a list of everything Sanborn's ever done. So I'm like, okay, I'll make a list of everything Sanborn's ever done. So I start writing to all these art galleries and different places, and I find out that after he made cryptos, he made another piece which he called the Untitled Cryptos piece, which he then sold to private collectors. So I tracked down the private collector. This is one of the dot-com millionaires living in California now, and he installed in his backyard, and I called him up and I said, hi, I'm Ilanka. Can I come into your backyard and take pictures of your art? He said, sure. He's collected other things, like he has an Enigma machine in his living room, and he just likes, and these things are like $50,000 a pop. They're not cheap. But he just likes collecting crypto things. So I went in and I found that some interesting things about it. One side of it has all the text of cryptos, the plain text, but in a slightly different order. And then it also has the Visionaire tableau, but again, positioned differently. And then the other side, completely different, it's all encrypted Russian text in the Cyrillic language. So encrypted text and then an encrypted Visionaire tableau. I'll talk about Visionaire in a sec. Along with that piece, Sanborn made another piece which was 20% larger for a different art installation. And that one is now publicly visible at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C., that big oval art museum along the mall. And it's the picture on the bottom right there, and it's called Antipodes. identical text to what's on the Untitled Cryptos piece, just a little bit larger. Okay. And that Russian side of the text is repeated on another of Sanborn's sculptures, which is called the Cyrillic Projector. This is one that's at, is currently at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. Anybody that's been there, it's between the Friday and the Fretwell buildings. And what, at night, a light is on and it shines encrypted text all around the courtyard. Sanborn is an artist like this because he liked the idea of when he had it as part of an art installation in a gallery. As people walked through the gallery, they had encrypted text covering them as they would go through, and he liked the artistic elements of that. So something else I discovered about the difference between these, the Untitled Cryptos piece and the one at CIA headquarters is a couple dots. So for one thing, you know, the order is different. So on Cryptos, and I'll tell you what Cryptos is in a minute, the if you number the parts 1, 2, 3, 4, so we call them K1, K2, K3, K4, well, on the Untitled piece, it starts with K3. It goes 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, and then it like chops off halfway through 2. Another interesting thing is right around here, there's two dots. And these dots appear on the Untitled piece, but don't appear on the Cryptos sculpture. Why? We don't know. We don't know. If they were to appear on Cryptos, they'd probably be right about there. So, how is Cryptos solved? Well, one side is a visionaire tableau, which you can see there's an alphabet here and an alphabet coming here, and like, you got all these diagonals, MMM, NNN. It's what's called a polyalphabetic substitution cipher. So, to do it, first you're going to make a key alphabet. So you take the 26 letters of the alphabet, you take your first key, in this case the key is the word Cryptos, and you put all those letters on the left, and then you leave the rest of the letters behind. So you still have 26 letters, but they're scrambled in a very specific kind of scheme. Okay. And then if you were to take all of those and line them up so that each one is like shifted by one character, so you like look at the Q's, and the Q's all go in a diagonal, and the W's, so you get these nice diagonals. And an artifact of this is you can see the key Cryptos here, but you can also read it vertically here, Cryptos. Now we're going to make it harder. Instead of spelling the word Cryptos, we're going to spell a different word down the left column. In this case, we're going to spell the word palimpsest. Palimpsest is a word for a scroll that has had one message written on it, then that message was scraped off and another message was written on top. So you can still see bits of the old message showing through. It can be used for scrolls, it can be used for other contexts such as a city. The city of Rome is a palimpsest. You could be standing on a street corner, see modern office buildings, but also see Roman ruins showing through, and medieval cathedrals, so you're seeing bits of the past showing through. Okay. So we make this tableau with our two keys, Cryptos and palimpsest. Cryptos, by the way, is Greek for the word hidden. And part one is these top two lines of the sculpture, so EMUFPHZ. And using the keys of Cryptos and palimpsest, take EMUFP, put each letter on a different line, an E becomes a B, an M becomes an E, a U becomes a T, an F becomes a W, a P becomes an E, and so forth. So EMUFPHZ becomes BETWEEN, between. You get a plain text. And you keep doing that and repeating it, and you get the whole plain text, which is, there's our ciphertext, our keys, our plain text, between subtle shading, and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. There's a cue there. Is that a typo on the slide? Nope. It's carved that way into sculpture. I asked Sanborn. I said, was it a mistake on the sculpture? He said, nope. He said, it's deliberate. But he said, it's not what it is that's so important. It's where it is. It's the orientation or the positioning. I also asked him, is that line from somewhere? Is it from a poem or a play? And he said, nope, it's an original sentence written by him with carefully chosen wording. Don't know what that means. Just share. Okay, part two starts here, goes all the way down to the bottom of this plate, top plate. Here's the ciphertext. Now, on this one, he did admit at one point that he made a mistake a few years ago, that he'd left a letter out way at the bottom, an S, which completely changed the plain text after it. And the plain text used the same method as part one, polyalphabetic substitution, but instead of Cryptos and palimpsest, use the keys of Cryptos and abscissa. Abscissa is a word for an x-coordinate and a graph. Plain text. It was totally invisible. How's that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field, X. The information was gathered and transmitted underground to an unknown location, X. does Langley know about this? They should. It's buried out there somewhere, X. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. This was his last message, X. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by Rose. At least we thought it was ID by Rose. When we put in that missing S, it changed the last part to say X, layer 2. Okay. I'll show you in a minute where those coordinates point to. Who's WW? There was lots of speculation about this. Dan Brown tried to say that WW was upside down MM and stood for Mary Magdalene. No, it does not. The Sanborn has said WW stands for William Webster, who was the director of the CIA at the time that the sculpture was installed. He was really the driving force behind getting some interesting art around the area. Right. Was there a question over here? No, okay. All right. Then part three starts at the top of this plate, goes all the way down to about the fourth row from the bottom. This is the ciphertext for part three. Those of you who have ever done cryptanalysis will probably notice something a little different about this ciphertext from the ciphertext for parts one and two. You may notice there's more vowels here. Lots of E's and T's and A's. So this is English here. This isn't substitution. This is what's called a transposition system. All the letters in the message are there. They're just scrambled. So we need to figure out how to unscramble them. This is a method that I came up with where I took all the letters and lined them up in rows. Starting middle of this final column, I took an S and then you count down four. One, two, three, four, you get to an L. Down four, you get to an O. Down four, W, L, Y. So S, L, O, W, L, Y, slowly. You keep doing that, you get these lovely diagonals, and you get the plain text coming out. Slowly, desperately, plain text. Slowly, desperately slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner, and then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist. X. Can you see anything? Q. Anyone recognize that? King Tut. Yep. This is a paraphrased extract from November 26, 1922, diary of Howard Carter, on the day he discovered King Tut's tomb in Egypt. Sanborn always liked that passage. He said that uncovering a tomb was similar to solving a code, that you're wiping away the layers. So again, we have those layers and seeing the message emerge. Then we have part four. Can't tell you what it says. We don't know. 97 characters. One of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. It would be starting about there and then go down to the bottom of that plate. So where do the coordinates point to? So this on the right, and I apologize if folks in the back are having trouble seeing this. On the right, we have the original CIA headquarters building. On the left, this is the new headquarters building. This white building with the funny shaped roof in the middle, that's the cafeteria. Sanborn designed this courtyard. So people eating in the cafeteria can look out this bank of windows and see artwork here. Kryptos is in this part of the courtyard. Sanborn, again, designed this entire courtyard, and he also designed some pieces here outside the entrance to the new headquarters building. Give you a better view here. Again, white shape, or white roof with funny shape. Here's some trucks down here, if you can see them, to kind of give you an idea of context of size. Windows all along this side of the cafeteria. Nice courtyard here. Duck pond. Kryptos is right here. We think the coordinates point right about here, about 150 feet southeast of the sculpture. Some say, okay, was it just approximate? Well, think of the latitude, which was 6.5 seconds north. Any geocachers in here? They've played a little bit. A tenth of a second, not 6.4, not 6.5, a tenth of a second of latitude is a very specific location, about 10 feet across. So that it would say 6.5 seconds, it's very precise, and he actually used a USGS Geological Service benchmark nearby to make sure he was getting things right. So he has confirmed that those coordinates are exact, but we have no idea why they're pointing here. There's nothing there. There are these dots. These are lunch tables, but you can drag them around. They're not stationary. It's possible there's something in second layer. There's something underground. CIA is not just, you know, ground floor. There's many layers underground. So, you know, maybe he hid something in a ceiling tile. We don't know. Okay. Here's another, sorry? Maybe it's where he ate lunch. You never know. You never know. So again, here's another view. We have the cafeteria, courtyard, duck pond, cryptos is here, and then these other pieces here. Now these have some Morse code messages on them. All right. So we have one grouping here, so grouping one, two, and then a small unmarked stone there. And these things say such things as SOS, shadow forces, lucid memory, T is your position, virtually invisible. And there's also a lodestone, which is tying into his themes of magnetism from earlier in his work. And there's a compass rose carved. But north is not pointing to north, and the needle is not pointing to north. But we believe that this is tying into his earlier work. He has two other pieces around the DC area that also have compass roses. And yes, we've gone and looked to see which way they're all pointing, to see if they intersect somewhere. But no, nothing there. It seems to be just a reference to his other kinds of work. And these pictures, by the way, were taken by Jim Galogli, who did get on CIA grounds and after he saw the first three parts. Okay, and here's just some more things showing these different rocks in different locations, the coordinates. Sanborn has said that this diagonal with these slabs was intended to be parallel with this diagonal. So, again, maybe he's doing something weird with a triangle or pentagram or who knows. And then here's the triangle block. No Morse code messages, just sitting out there. Maybe it's related, maybe not, we don't know. Other things we've discovered are that on the visionaire tableau side, there's an extra L. This line should end with a J, but it ends with an L, so we have two lines that end with an L. And this L is on the same height above the ground as on the other side of the tableau where there are some letters out of alignment. So possibly that's a hint. For example, on the Cyrillic projector, which we did solve, it uses also a polyalphabetic substitution system. Two keywords, one of them being Chen, which means darkness, and one which means, and Medusa, which is the mythological character. So if you go there, or you went there right after it was installed, you could see the word Medusa illuminated on the wall. And anyone who was a student of languages would recognize this because there is no Cyrillic S. You know, that's a Roman S. There is no Cyrillic D. There's a D sound, but that D is not the way they would write it in Cyrillic. So this is a hint about one of the keys. Well, where does it come from on the sculpture? It comes from the third row up. And John Wilson, a DragonCon attendee who I don't think is here today, he went out there and took a look, and he saw that on that third row, there was an extra bolt, which is kind of hard to see here. But if you look from the inside, it was really obvious. And it was the only bolt like that on the entire sculpture. So maybe that was Sanborn's way of trying to draw the eye to this line, saying there was a hint. So it's possible that Cryptos has something like that, and we just don't know it because we can't get in to see it. So I've met Sanborn several times. I've taken him out to dinner. I've bought him drinks, you know, tried to pump him for information. You know, I get these little pieces of info. I've also gone out with Ed Scheidt, who taught him about codes. And Scheidt has said a few interesting things. He said that he did things to mask the English in part four. He said, we solved the first three parts and we had the advantages of the English language, the frequency counting and whatnot. and he said we could solve those by weighting the English language, but he removed that advantage for part four. He also said we solved the first three parts without recovering the keys first, which might imply that there's keys there. He said a couple times that he designed a code could be designed such that you would tell someone a key, and then 20 years later, they might be there, and they may have forgotten the key, but there's a way that they can remind themselves of the key, something in the surroundings. So it's possible that there's some way that the keys are hidden that we just haven't figured out. All the keys, we did it by reverse engineering and putting computer attacks on it. He also said he used a little bit of steganography on it, but he has confirmed that it's solvable, that it's definitely in English, and he said it also uses all the letters. Mm-hmm. And now Sanborn also gave a hint. This was in 2010, the 20-year anniversary of the sculpture. He called up the New York Times and he said, I'm going to give you one of the words of the plain text. And starting at the 64th character, so this is part four, so 64th is here, NYPVTT is the ciphertext. He said, the plain text at that location is the word Berlin. Big flurry of activity when he made that announcement, and we found some stuff. For one example, we took all of those polyalphabetic substitution, the methods that were used for K1 and K2, saying if we use those methods, what keys would we need to get Berlin to show up at that spot? And we found something with interesting keys, plausible, the words shifted and binary, that would produce the word Berlin in that exact spot. However, there's nothing intelligible before, and there's nothing intelligible after. Also, we found that there are several other keys that will also produce the word Berlin right there, like subcompact Gorky will also produce. Now, all of these produce that same thing. So it's not a unique key pair. So we don't know if it's just an interesting observation or something that might actually be leading us in. Okay. We're also wondering if Berlin, was it the city, or was it two words combined, like amber line would have Berlin, or number of links could have the word Berlin. But Sanborn has confirmed that no, it is the city Berlin. And then we've used what's called cribs in trying to say, well, if the word Berlin is there, what word would be after it? Berlin Wall, Berlin Tunnel, Berliner, what would be before it? West Berlin, East Berlin. And so we've tried all these attacks, but really haven't come up with anything. And Sanborn has said he'll give another clue in another 10 years. and he said that even after we solve part four, that there will be a remaining mystery, because he thinks that art should always have something that draws the viewer's interest. If a viewer is looking at a piece of art and they understand everything to do with the art, he thinks it's not very good art. There should always be something inspirational about the art. Then there's alignment. There is this one line with these letters out of alignment. And remember when I said there was that extra L, it's on that same line of the sculpture. And I've showed my slides to Sanborn, and he has said, this is important. But we don't know what that means. Okay. Also, this is the picture that was on the CI website for a long time. And Sanborn contacted me, and he said, please tell them to stop using that picture. It's looking at cryptos from the side. And he said, it's an ugly picture of cryptos. And I'm like, well, what? I said, what's the front? He said, this one. This is the front of cryptos. Maybe it's a clue, maybe not. But he was very insistent that he wanted my website and Wikipedia and everything else to show the cryptos from that particular view. So Berlin, possibly is it related to the Berlin Wall? When the Berlin Wall was coming down, that was 1989. Cryptos was being created in 1988, 1990. Berlin was definitely big in the news. And there is a Berlin Wall monument at CIA. Possibly the coordinates are meant to point to where that monument was going to be. Maybe there were some plans for it. Yeah, don't know. Right now, the Berlin Wall Monument is not there. Again, cryptos here, coordinates point there. The actual Berlin Wall Monument is over here, but the plans may have been different at the time he was installing it. We don't know. Also, I would say that don't get too excited about all the graffiti on there, because it's not from the original Berlin Wall. When the CIA got those pieces, the pieces are from the Berlin Wall, but they had no paint on them. The CIA hired an artist to go in and paint graffiti onto those pieces of the wall. part four. Don't know what it says? Can't tell you. So almost to the end here, just very briefly about cryptos and pop culture. So we have the book The Da Vinci Code, as I mentioned, that has a couple puzzles referring to cryptos. One of them is on the back here in that brown tear area, very, very faintly. It says only WW knows. And also on the back, you can't see it here, but very faintly, light red on dark red, there are some numbers that say 37 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west. Then, as I said, these were clues to lost symbol. Already told you about the NOLA K part. So why hasn't K4 been solved yet? It's short, only 97 characters, which makes it really, really difficult. It's possible there's something on CIA ground, some way of recovering the keys, and we just don't know it because we can't get on site. It's possible we've missed something. We might have been misdirected. Scheidt has said the answer's in English. Maybe it's in German. Maybe it's in ancient Phoenician. Don't know. That would make it much more difficult. It's also possible that they just screwed it up. Any game developers that you talk to, ask them about new game developers and common mistakes that are made by game developers or puzzle designers. And often people will create a puzzle or a game and then they don't test it. And they put it out there and no one can solve it because there's just something wrong with it. So it's possible that Sanborn made a mistake. But since then we've really kind of leaned on him pretty hard about, is he sure he did it right? And he did admit that there was that one other mistake in part two. So I'm pretty confident that it's accurate. I've also really gotten on Ed Scheidt's case. How do you know it's done right? Maybe he made a mistake and Scheidt was, I'm sure it's done right. So, you know, okay. I believe it's solvable. So, quick summary. Crypto's four codes. Three of the four have been solved. Part four hasn't been solved yet. It's short. There might be a mistake. But they have said it's solvable. And my goal is not necessarily to be the person that solves it. I just want to see it solved. So I give talks about it and share as much information as I can on my website. There's a discussion group, which everyone here is welcome to join. You don't have to be some fancy cryptographer. Just come in and be constructive, and you're welcome to join. Website is ilanka.com/cryptos. You can also just go to Google and find a lot of good stuff. There's also a pretty good NOVA documentary about it at pbs.org. there are, this is a book that was written after The Lost Symbol came out, which is a collection of articles by academics about the fact and fiction of Brown's novel. I've got two articles in there about cryptos. And if you just want to learn more about cryptography in general, I would recommend the two books I recommend. One is by Simon Singh. It's called The Code Book. Very good book. Very readable. And if you want to get deeper into it, I would get a book by David Kahn called The Code Breakers, which really goes into the history of cryptography. So, any questions? In the back. Toss him the box.
We only got time for this one question.
Okay.
So.
All right. And then any other questions, people are welcome to come up or take a look at the Voynich manuscript that I got here.
Does the fact that there's a one-for-one correspondence to the ciphertext and the plain text mean that it's just a substitution cipher?
That's a really good question. We've asked Sanborn. We've asked Sanborn if the NYP corresponds to the BER in Berlin, or does it just mean that Berlin shows up there, but it's, you know, the transposition that it relates to something else? And I'm not sure he entirely understands the question. But he has said that Berlin is intended to start at the 64th character. So take that for what it's worth.
Since the last two characters
yeah, substitution. Anyway, thank you all for coming. And I would just remind you, when you're trying to solve something, pathological persistence. Thank you.